Very, very briefly, we have been looking here at the section of the Rambam's classic encyclopedic work on the halachic aspect of the Torah, in which he, in this particular section, discusses many basic aspects of Jewish philosophy, but in this particular subsection, discusses the very severe and difficult area of what things a person can do or omit to do that are so severe that they could jeopardize a person's whole spiritual being. Okay? That means he could cut off his connection with the spiritual world, lose his share in the world to come, as he says here. And we've discussed lots of aspects of what that means before, we're not going to go into it now, but that's the basic overall idea here. And so far we've discussed that of these 13 categories that he discusses, we've looked at the ones that deal with the basic fundamentals of spiritual being, which means a knowledge of a higher world, it means a consciousness that there is something besides just the animal level. Some details about that, person has to know certain details about Hashem, that he's only one, that he has no corporeal element, various other essentials. We then looked at the, which is the section that we're dealing with right now, is that there are three subgroups of people who are called Abikosin, heretics, deniers, people who have some particular spiritual block. And the ones that we've looked at so far are as follows. Somebody who says that there's no Nevuah, that means no prophecy, that means he acknowledges that there's a higher world, but he feels there's no connection between that world and this. Again, as we've explained many times, it's not somebody who just chooses to say that, or someone who doesn't know, and that's why he says we're talking about people who know what they're talking about, and consciously with a tremendous, powerful level of knowledge deny. They have to know what you deny, as we said before. Secondly, somebody who says that Moshe Rabbeinu was not on a level necessarily different from other prophets. That means he could understand that there was such a thing, is such a thing as prophecy, but he just feels that that particular great teacher that we had, Moshe Rabbeinu, he says that his particular prophecy is non-existent or not different than other prophets. We discussed the reasons for that strange statement as well before. And thirdly, I think what we saw last time, that Hashem does not know, someone who says that the Kodesh Baruch Hu, Hashem, the Creator, does not know what is a person's, what goes on here. In other words, he doesn't know. He doesn't know what we are busy doing. And as we pointed out last time, he doesn't know what we're thinking either. Right? He knows what we do and what we think. Any of these three fits into that category that's called Abikosin, which are people who deny an intrinsic and critical element of the spiritual world. Are there any questions? Sunday night is been set aside for question night, so you may feel free to ask questions which I can answer. But let's see the next, we're going to move on to the next section, okay? Is everyone happy so far? Okay. Last week we spent the whole evening in response to questions discussing thought control and what it means when certain thoughts, what thoughts you're responsible for, the negative effect of thoughts, and so forth. Anyone who's interested in that subject, I think a recording was made, and you are referred to that recording. Let's see the next statement. It says as follows. They're also in the same subheading that we began. It says this. There are three subcategories in this subcategory, as follows. Shloshahen akufrim b'Torah. There are three kinds, there are three people who are deniers of the Torah. Okay? That means not just the prophecy element that we discussed before, and not just the difference in the levels of prophecy between regular Nevi'im, prophets, and the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, but people who specifically deny Torah. Okay? That means they know about Hashem, they know about the spiritual world, they know there's a creator, they know a lot of details about him, they know there are many things that they do know and they do acknowledge, right? That means they're already in the category of being people who relate to the spiritual world, but they do not know about Torah, or rather they know and they deny. We're going to get into very, very tricky areas over here, okay? Tiger country in terms of sects of Jews who believe certain things that they believe are Torah and we understand that it's not Torah. We're going to have to discuss these painful issues as obliquely as we can with as little emotion as possible. On your part, I'm allowed to get emotional. However, first of all, as follows. First one. Somebody who says that the Torah is not from Hashem. Right? That means the Torah is human. You know, some human beings got together and put it together at some stage. They made up the story, or they, we'll see different varieties of this. But that means that there is such a thing as Torah, and it's a wonderful book. You know, it's a fantastic literature, and it's in fact one of the world's greatest bestsellers, probably the all-time bestseller that there ever was, and the fantastic poetry and deep human insights and the whole thing. But it's actually not from Hashem. Okay, he, although he exists, I mean, these are not people who deny his existence, but this is a human concoction. Afilu pasuk echad, even one verse, listen carefully, have to hear this well, this is what can cut a person off from his existence in the next world. I mean, all this needs to be proved. All we're doing right now is studying the facts. A lot of discussion and proof. A person wants to know how and why this operates, then they have to study the sources that talk about these things. Right now, the Rambam is only stating halacha. Let that be clear. You're not going to find in this work of the Rambam any proof to these issues. You're not attempting to set up proof. First of all, there's a lot of things here that can't be proved. And you will be surprised what can and what can't be proved. A lot of this can be proven, at least, let's put it this way, if not proven, can be put into a conceptual framework that makes a tremendous amount of sense. And certainly can be proven that it makes more sense to think that way than the alternative, even if you're not fulfilling a scientific definition of proof. That we have discussed here before, and I'll refer you to those discussions which have been recorded also. But this work that the Rambam wrote is purely halacha. That must be clear to everybody here. This is called the Mishneh Torah, in which the Rambam writes only halacha. That means Jewish obligation, not philosophy. He's not explaining all this or stating all this from a philosophical perspective, right? Why you should believe this, or why, how we know it, or what it means in spiritual terms, or the proofs, or let's not call it proofs, but the evidence in the world. It's got nothing to do with this section. Are you with me? It's a straightforward statement of fact, okay? You need to believe this and this and this, at least you need to know it, and the consequences are this and that and the other, but that's all. If you want to know why we should think this way, and how does this, can this appeal to my sense of logic and my sense of what I'm familiar with in the world, then you must look up the works that deal with it, and there are classics that do deal with this. Some of the classics are the Rambam himself. He wrote a book called the Moreh Nebuchim, which is a book, the title means Guide to the Perplexed, in which he attacks these issues on a very, very deep philosophical basis. Not on an emotional type of a basis, as others approach it. He approaches it on a purely philosophical basis, relating very deeply to Greek philosophy. He writes it in Arabic, which was the language of the intellectuals of his day. It was specifically written for people who have doubts or are skeptical. Very much so. And that's been well translated into English. The translations that I've seen are a little bit stiff and formal, but nevertheless you can work through it. You need a background in philosophy for some of the sections. But a person can read the Moreh Nebuchim. It's a long and very deep work. A person can read that. There are much more straightforward approaches, such as the Kuzari. It's a fantastic exposition of Jewish belief from a deeper point of view, connecting up with the psychological and the mystical, which is written by Yehuda Halevi, the Kuzari, written sometime after the Rambam. That's been well translated into English with notes as well. People can read that. All these works need further study, much more depth. You need a Rebbe. You need to discuss them in much more detail. But nevertheless, there are many classic works. And there are some later works also which go into some of these. And some of that has been digested, to the best of my ability, in a series of talks that we did here on a Monday night. And I think they called the series Emunah. And also they have the tapes. If a person wants to know the philosophical underpinnings and how all this fits together, what is the evidence from the world? How can we objectively look at all these basic issues of belief that a person doesn't have direct access to? Then you are welcome. You're referred to take out that set of cassettes. I think they called it Emunah number 0 through 7 or 8. I don't remember. There were 7 or 6 or 7 or 8 talks that we shared here on that subject, in which I tried to put this case, these factual issues, from a point of view of philosophy, and what it is, what tangible elements we can make connection with that back up these facts. And you'll find on those cassettes also references so that you can look it up further. But that's not what he's doing here. Here in these sessions on Sunday nights, we do try and discuss a little bit of the background of these subjects, but you will not find it in the words of the Rambam. Are you clear? Are you with me? There's not an argument here for the Jewish faith. There's just a statement of halachic obligation. You have to believe this and this and this, or rather you have to get to know it. You have to make an attempt to get to know it. And if you don't, then the consequences are serious. That's what we're studying here. Okay, and this particular principle is as follows. That you have to know that the Torah is from Hashem. That means it's divinely inspired, what they call divinely inspired. It means it's Hashem speaking. Every single verse, afilu pasuk echot, afilu teifa achas, even one word. You hear that? Even one word. If a person says that he believes in the whole Torah, and it's all fine, and it's all from Hashem, and it was given at Sinai, and it's all divine, and so forth and so on. But there's one word that he thinks was not quite right. Follow? That somebody got a bit wrong. Moshe Rabbeinu sort of changed the word here or there, for whatever reason. And he says that that was of human invention. Okay? And even if that word has no significance halakhically, he just thinks that the word doesn't fit. You know, it's poetic ring, you know. He's not right at that point. Okay? And he's convinced that that word is not divine like the rest of the Torah. So then that's breaking down the whole Torah. I'll try and explain this in a minute. But that's what he says. Let's just read the statement. Im Omar, if he says, Moshe Amro Mipi Atzmoi, if he says that Moses said it himself, in other words, there's a word there, or a line, a pasuk, or whatever section, however much you want to state, that makes no difference, that Moshe Rabbeinu himself said, in other words, Hashem didn't tell him to write that, he himself made it up, Harei Ze Kefir B'Torah. That is called somebody who denies Torah. It makes no difference how much. And even if he attributes it to Moshe, to Moses, it makes no difference. If it's not from Hashem directly, then that is, he is a denier of Torah. Okay, let's just stop there for a second. It gets much more difficult, okay? That's just the beginning. Most Jews don't have too much problem with this. You'll find that most Jews don't have too much trouble with this. Most Jews are ready to admit that if they prepare to think about something called a spiritual reality, which most people aren't, but if they are prepared to sort of think about it, then you put their backs up against the wall, and they prepare to admit that there may be some sort of divine thing, then probably what's written in the Torah is probably his word. Probably. Well, they wouldn't claim to know a lot about it to be able to prove it to you philosophically or intellectually, but they probably wouldn't have much trouble with that. The problem, always the problem, the deep problem, is that when it comes to what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh, the rabbinic interpretation, let's call it that, the oral law, let's call it that, that is where you will find, unfortunately, not only do most Jews have a problem, but most Jews firmly believe that that is human interpretation. Okay? And unfortunately, the Rambam states here quite clearly that even people who deny that and its divine origin are in the same category. That's a much more difficult discussion. So let's follow it step by step and try and understand this. The first element is this. Let's just try and slot in a little bit of understanding to some of these issues. The first thing that we have to slot in is this. Why is it that if a person doesn't believe that one word is divine like the rest, so why does it have as serious a set of consequences as if a person denies the whole thing? You follow? I mean, that doesn't make sense, really, if you think about it. If you apply that criteria to any other set of any other wisdom, then you'll see that the closer a person gets to the aggregate of the whole, the better it is. A person would understand that a certain text or a certain piece of writing, let's say, is correctly attributed. Only one word he's got a bit of a question about. So obviously that person's is a lot less of a debate with such an individual than someone who says that the whole thing's a fraud. Why is it that in Torah it makes no difference? That's a very challenging question. But a basic approach to that question is along the lines you've said before. There are many approaches to it. But just to give it a little bit of what's called time, a little bit of taste, we have approached it from the following point of view, and let's state it again, and that is this, that the whole essential thing to understand here is that the Torah is an organic entity. It's one living, throbbing, vital being. It's not a set of facts. Now, that's the key that you need to remember. If it's a set of facts, and I agree with 9 out of 10 facts on the list, and fact 10 I hold as independent fact and I don't agree with it, fine, there's something to talk about. But that's not what our conception of Torah is, and that's what comes through very strongly here. Our conception of Torah is that it's an organic living being, and just like any living entity, or even any mechanical entity that's all interconnected, cannot do without any of its parts. When a designer builds a machine, he makes sure that every piece he puts in is needed, and every piece contributes towards the overall function. He wouldn't put in pieces that aren't necessary, certainly not in this kind of machine, we understand. And therefore, any piece that is left out is a critical piece. If you want an analogy, I'll give you two analogies which make it much easier to picture. And then we'll try and discuss maybe some of the consequences. One beautiful analogy is if you think of something like a radio or some piece of electronic equipment. So then anybody, even if you're not technically minded at all, you'll understand there's no good telling me if I chop out a millimeter of wiring someplace in your radio and then you tell me that the thing won't work anymore. And I tell you, no, but on average most of it's there. You follow the very good average. In fact, I don't even have to remove a piece. All I have to do is just separate one wire by a millimeter, less than a millimeter. So the radio won't work. The majority of parts are there. You know, on average, you're doing very well. But things don't work that way. There's some things that work that way, and there's some things that don't work that way. When you're amassing facts, or you're amassing material in the world, so then it goes on averages. The more you have, one grain of rice or wheat, more or less, doesn't make much difference. But when you're dealing with an organic entity that's all interconnected, so then you can't afford to chop out a little piece. The whole circuit ceases to function. And that's the way Torah is. Torah is an integral circuit that functions from one end to the other. There isn't an end. But let's say throughout the whole circle or cycle. And therefore you cannot break the circuit or current anywhere. I don't want to go into detail here, but I would refer you to a fascinating area. I'm not competent to discuss it in detail. And I don't want to bore those who have been through it, maybe know more about it than I do. But I'll just refer you to an issue which is hard to understand, but critically important. Okay, let's not spend too much time on it, but you have to know about it. And that is that Let's put it this way. Who here is not aware of what's meant by the codes, the hidden mathematical codes in Torah? Who's not aware? You're either not being honest, or quite a few people. Alright, okay. I don't blame you. You don't have to feel bad. Recently discovered, the last 10 years or so. And a fascinating area. I'm going to tell you very briefly about it at the risk of boring those who do know. Even those who do know, I hope you'll find at least one or two details interesting and illuminating. But very briefly, something like this. Again, if you're interested in the subject, I suggest right away that we have a special evening. We can devote an evening to this. We can get international experts in this to present it beautifully. It's been very beautifully graphically done in the form of slides and graph presentations. We can actually see these things operate. To hear me describe it to you is going to sound like some sort of fantasy. But it can be very beautifully demonstrated. Rabbi Ordman is a world-famous expert. He was here a year ago, who presented it once in Johannesburg. And we can arrange that again, I'm sure, if you pressurize Rabbi Mohsen. Even mildly, he'll arrange it for you. There are big catches to this whole discussion, which we'll have to go through also. But let's at least try and lay down the basic principles, okay? I'm only doing this to illustrate this point and give it some sort of time. It's not a proof of anything, okay? We're not trying to get to any proofs here, but we want to try and experience something together that is a very, very illuminating insight into this fact. I'll tell you very briefly the story. A few years ago, approximately 10 years ago, two Israelis, mathematicians, decided to apply certain computer tests to the text of the Torah. There were many motivations for it, I'm not going to go into it now, but they tried to apply certain computer analysis to the text of the Torah. The first attempt actually was an attempt to analyze Bereshit, the book of Genesis, in this particular mathematical fashion. Very, very briefly, and I'm not competent to tell you all the details, but very briefly, are there no seats? I get upset if you have to stand. Are there no seats at all? Okay, so this is what happened. Very briefly, it's much more sophisticated and complicated than this, but I'll tell you very briefly the idea. The idea is this, that they took, the first two people that did it, if I'm not mistaken, weren't religious at all. If I'm not mistaken, I might be wrong about that detail. People who involved later very much became an interest of the religious world, but it became a very deep interest of the mathematical and statistical academic world also. And I'll try and tell you about that briefly also. But what happened was this. They analyzed the text of Bereshit, the formal, conventional, traditional text that we have. As you know, there are other texts. There's a thing called the Masoretic text, which differs from ours by a few letters here and there. There is argument about which is the correct one. We firmly believe that what we use in the Sefer Torah is correct. The Rambam will say later that you have to believe that specifically, that that's the same as what was given at Sinai. And if not, so then you're a denier of Torah also. And this mathematical analysis was an incredibly unexpected way of proving this particular point. What they did was this. They took the text of Genesis and they fed it in to a computer in the following way. They basically wrote the text of Bereshit. Subsequently, it's been done with the whole Torah. Into the computer in such a way that the first letter of Bereshit is designated 1, the second letter 2, and so forth, without counting any spaces between the words. Are you with me? In other words, they wrote the whole text of Bereshit as if it were one long word, ignoring spaces between the words. Are you with me? Which means that the whole Torah then was as if you had a number sequence from 1 through 300,000, or however many letters there are. There are about 300,000 letters in the Torah. That's what they did. They then decided to see whether the mathematical, whether the pattern that's formed by these letters has any significance. Okay? So one of the first tests they did was they decided to try and read that long word instead of reading every consecutive letter as we normally do, but let's say let's read every 7th letter and it spelled out a whole new story. Okay? Then every 49th letter, every 50th, all mystical significant intervals, they tried to read and they came up with the most incredible discoveries. Okay? I'm not going to go into detail, I'll tell you one or two. For example, if you take the first Aleph in the Torah, and you count from that Aleph, right, the number of letters that appear in the Megillah's Esther, okay, however many thousand letters appear in the Megillah of Esther, you take the Aleph and you count that number of letters, you get to a Samach. If you count again, you get to a Taf, and if you count again, you get to Rashi. It spells the word Esther. Okay? Now, are you with me? That means the word Esther is spelled out in the Torah at intervals of the number of letters that appear in the beginning of Esther. Now you know the word Esther means to be hidden. The word itself means that I will be hidden and you'll have to discover me. Right? They then analyze this statistically to see what are the chances of such an event happening by chance, or in fact any meaningful word. And they checked it against other texts, including newspapers, including other languages like Tamil and various other Hebrew texts and other texts, and very significantly against the Masoretic text and other texts of Torah that didn't operate at all in any of them, not any patterns at all. But one or two rare exceptions, which I'm not going to go into now. Very faint echoes of this, which is a very interesting subject in its own right. But let's just try and get the basics done. And then they found that some of the patterns that can be discovered this way are of the most incredible complexity. Most incredible complexity. I'll just share with you one very briefly, just to give you some idea. The creativity of the minds who even thought to look for these patterns is very startling. But what they did was, one of the things they did was, according to certain mystical traditions, we know that certain number sequences and intervals are significant. Okay? So they started looking for some, and they found, remarkably, very interestingly, they found that the four species, just to give you an example, okay? You can look it up, by the way, you can see it graphically represented. Many magazines have come out with it in Hebrew, but even if you don't speak Hebrew, it doesn't matter. You'll see the patterns are clearly, they're drawn out in a graphic form. You can actually see it in the text. They found that if you look for where the Torah describes the four species, you know what I'm talking about, a lulav, an esrog, a hadas, and an arava. You know what, the four things we shake on Sukkot. So there's a very interesting thing, is that the word esrog is not mentioned in the Torah. You know, it says, you'll take four species, lukachnem lachem by yom rishon, on the first day you must take for you, pre-eitz hadar, you must take the fruit of a beautiful tree, kapois tamarim, alulav, and so forth, but it never says the word esrog. It only says the fruit of a beautiful tree, which could be in many different fruits. How do we know that it's an etrog? So how do we know? We know it through the oral law, and I'm using this example because it illustrates this point. We know through the oral tradition that that fruit is an esrog. Are you with me? But it doesn't say so anywhere in Torah. But we have a deep mystical tradition that anything that we know in the oral law is actually hidden in the written text of the Torah also. Because the Torah itself is the blueprint of the universe. So therefore nothing can exist in the world unless it's built into the genes or the structure or the mechanism, the circuitry of Torah. You follow? We don't understand that Torah is a deep document. We understand that it's the structure of the genetic material that actually forms the world. And therefore you can't possibly find anything in the world unless it is in the text of Torah. No one says it's revealed. If it's a thing that's hidden in the world, then it'll be hidden in the Torah. And we have many, many deep traditions about this. And Aaron Kotler always used to say that there's a fantastic idea, this. The reason that the next world is not mentioned openly in Torah, why is it when you read the text of the Torah, the Bible, right, Chumash, you will not find an open reference to the next world? Nothing could be more important than that. Why is it not mentioned openly, but only mentioned obliquely and in many hidden ways? Obviously, since the next world is hidden in this world, it must be hidden in Torah. If it were revealed openly in the Torah, then you'd be able to see it openly here. Do you follow? That's not a poetic sort of coincidence. It has to be that way. If the Torah itself reveals a thing, it means if you look in the world, you'll see that thing. And if the Torah hides a thing, it means you have to look in the world and find it hidden. Are you with me? He actually, they say, a beautiful example, they say that, how does the Torah choose what to hide and what not to hide? So the basic rule is, that which you need more is less hidden. If you need something immediately, it's very explicitly to be found. For example, you need air in the world, so it's very plentiful. You need water, yes, you do, but you need it less than air. You can go a few hours without that. So you'll find it grouped together in certain places on the earth, but not as available as air, but very readily available. And so forth. Everything you need, you'll find in proportion. Diamonds, so you don't exactly need, although you might think otherwise, you don't exactly need diamonds at a moment's notice. And so you have to dig very deep, very, very deep, very expensive and detailed process to get hold of them. Gold, diamonds, they're very deep. The Torah is the same way. You want to know how to live your life, what you're allowed to do with somebody else's wife? Well, you can't tell me that you have to dig very deep, you know, it's easily discovered, right? Or what your obligations are towards somebody else's property and so forth, that's absolutely clearly stated. But you want to know that the laws regarding certain complicated mathematical relationships, so you have to figure them out in Torah. They're there, but they're very deeply buried. Are you with me? Once you get time, I'll show you a fantastic place in Torah where the derivation of pi, the mathematical derivation of pi, right? The mathematics governing that incredible figure are actually derived from a pasuk in Torah. That's how they knew about it. I'll try and show you that also. It's nothing to do with codes. It's a straightforward pshat in a pasuk. But anyway, be that as it may, that's the rule. Now, therefore, how do we approach? So here we have a thing called an esrog. Now, we know the oral law tells us an esrog. However, we'd like to find it in the text somewhere, and the text does not state it. So what they did was they set about looking through certain mystical hints where the Torah mentions the other three. And it so happens that they discovered one pattern in which the other three are mentioned is as follows. I'm not going into detail, but generally it's like this. You know that of the five books of the Torah, the middle one stands out as being unusual. Because it's Sefer Vayikra deals with the laws of Kohanim and the Beit Hamikdash. Almost nothing else there. Almost nothing else besides that. There's a mystical tradition that the first two and the last two spell Hashem's name. Yud-K, Vav-K are spelled by the first two in the last two books. I'm not going to go into reasons for all this, but that's what it is. And it so happened, so they thought maybe that's the place to look, because if you're looking for a set of four out of the five, you look at the first two and the last two. And they found that in Bereshis and in Shmois and in Bamidbar, in the first, second, and fourth, you can find Lulav, Hadas, and Arava spelled out in the following way, very, very roughly, like this. You go to, it's complicated, but basically you look for Hashem's name. You look for the first time Hashem's name appears in that book, in the form that is characteristic of that particular book, because Hashem's name takes different forms, and it has different characteristic forms depending on which book you're looking in, and the reason for that is because each book deals with a different subject. Genesis deals with Hashem himself. Right? Shmos deals with the formation of the Jewish people. Vayikra is an exception, it deals with the Kohanim. Bamidbar deals with the Oel Moed, where Hashem and us meet, the tent of meeting in the desert. Beautiful, no? And Dvarim deals with putting it all together at the end, as the end always does. So there's a theme that follows, and therefore we look for the words that are significant. Hashem's name in the first book. In the second book, we look at the formation of the Jewish people. We take the first time the word B'nai Israel appears. In the third, we take Oel Moed, which is the subject matter of that book. And in the fourth, so there was a reason for doing it that way. The first time it appears, you then count up the number of letters that are characteristic of that book. In the first book it's 10 because it's the Yud of Yud-K, Vav-K, are you with me? In the second book it's Hay because it's the Hay of Yud-K, Vav-K. Never mind the details now. I mean, but the point is you do that. And then you get to a certain letter. And it so happens that the letter you get to in the first book is, let's say, it's the Ayin of Arava. And then however many steps you've been through, you count that number of steps, and the next letter you get is a Resh, and then a Beit, and it spells out the word Arava. Okay? That's what it does. The myrtle. You know the myrtle or the, what? The willow. The willow. And then the next one, it spells Hadas. Okay, and the next one spells Lulav. I might have the order wrong. And therefore, let's see what happens in the fourth book if we do the same pattern. And it spells out Esrek. Okay? In other words, you have the same code spelling out in exactly the same way all three things, although we know that they're revealed. The fourth one that isn't revealed, we know we must find it hidden, is spelled out in the same very, very complex and exacting code exactly to the number, to the letter. And they've made statistical analyses of, you know, the level of statistical significance, if you're a mathematician, that can be attached to some things. There was a famous objection raised to this whole process. Before I tell you that, let me just tell you, for those who are new, I see there are quite a few new hands, so I'm going to blow your minds. Okay, you hold on to your shaitel for this. Since you're new, but just to give you some feeling, right? And that's only the men. Let's just to give you a bit of an appreciation of it, let me tell you one more detail. In recent years, someone devised a method of showing this in a very beautiful fashion. I'm not going to go into the details. You've got a mathematical mind, you'll pick it up immediately. What they do is this. Because we want to look at intervals, you've got equidistant number sequences, that's what they call them. Because we want to look at intervals, a very beautiful way to do it, instead of counting numbers laboriously, or even setting the computer to count numbers, there's a fantastic way you can do it. Brilliant. It was a very, very simple, but a brilliant thing. What they do is, let's say you want to look at words of intervals of 49 in the Torah. So a brilliant way to do it is simply write the Torah text on lines 49 letters long. Are you with me? You follow. In other words, you start with a base of Bereshis, and you write 49 letters, and then you start the 50th on the next line below it, and so you end up with a grid, a long narrow grid, okay, of one long column, 49 letters long. Now obviously any word that is spaced 49 letters apart, you just read directly downwards. Are you follow? From the first base of Bereshis, the 49th letter after that will be the letter just on the line below that, and so forth, and so you follow, you read the grid down, or 48 letter, whatever it is, you read it down. And of course you can have fantastic patterns that way. You can look for words that are spelled 49 plus 1. Because to do that you'll just read diagonally down. You follow? Each line becoming one longer than the line you looked for before. Or you could read 49 minus 1 in equidistant intervals by reading at angles. And you could read, of course, across, down, up, backwards, forwards, whatever you could do. They then wrote the Torah. You might not believe me, okay? I don't expect you to. You're going to check it out for yourself. I actually counted out the first few because I actually was very skeptical when I sat there for ages counting out the letters to prove to my own computer that it actually works. But they did the following test. They set out prospectively to look for things. You see, discovering things that are there after the fact, the mathematicians objected to. Because maybe, you know, those are the things that are there, but there are millions of things that aren't there. You follow the argument? Yeah, so you found those. Very nice. So there are dozens of incredible coincidences, but there are millions of things that I'd like to find that aren't there. So mathematically, to be rigorous, you have to set out to look for something and then find it. That's a much more powerful test. So they set out in various ways. There was one fantastic experiment that was done that was sent to the world's top mathematicians, statisticians. A number of mathematicians almost lost their jobs because of it. Someone in the Hebrew University told me that he became so fascinated with it from the math department that he devoted a whole thesis to this thing, and they tried to fire him because they defined it not as mathematics but as statistics. And there was a big tussle in the department, and a lot of mathematical departments were thrown into turmoil about this, including certain ones in England, where they sent some of this work for verification. But at the moment, it still stands up to the most rigorous mathematical testing. I'm not going to go into the details. You can check it up yourself. I've got a paper at home, I think, somewhere, in technical language, showing the mathematics involved. But just to give you some idea, one of the experiments that they did, and this has become one of the more famous ones because it's very dramatic, was they tried to find associations between things that we would expect to be in Torah and expect to be hidden. For example, certain historical facts. Let's take a historical event. Now, we know that the Torah codes for all of reality. And therefore, you must find somewhere in Torah, let's say that one of the famous things they looked for was the Dreyfus trial. You remember the French army officer who was accused of treason, and there was a tremendous anti-Semitic thing about it. The Dreyfus trial was an event that happened that's significant in history. So therefore, it must be in Torah somewhere. Of course, you won't find it openly, but if you know how to read the text, you must find that written. So they tried to look for that, and many other historical and physical phenomena and facts. What they did was this. Very, very interesting technique. Fascinating technique. They decided to look for the word that they were looking for. Let's say in this case, Dreyfus. Now that, you have to spell out in Hebrew. So let's spell out the word Dreyfus in Hebrew. You with me? And let's find which interval codes for the word Dreyfus at its minimal level. Of course, this would take you years to do. But with a computer, you can search for such a thing easily. Let me explain to you very briefly. This is what they do. Let's say you're looking for the word Dreyfus, okay? You read the text of the Torah from Bereishis until you come to the first Dalet. Are you with me? You now go to the first time a resh appears after that. Okay? And you count the number. Let's say there are 10 letters in between. You then count 10 more letters and see if you get to the next letter of that word. If you do, you keep going until you spell out the word completely. If you fail, you then go back to the beginning and you this time look for the next sequence, one longer than the one you tried before. And then count at that number of intervals. Until eventually you find an interval that may be very long, in some of these cases of thousands, not hundreds or thousands of letters, at which you can spell out the whole word at equidistant number intervals. Are you with me, anybody? Anybody at all? Not so bad at explaining, eh? Okay, so now, listen, in the 9 days, if you don't have a laugh about something. Okay, so this is what happens. So now they take a word like Dreyfus. Let's say it's spelled out at intervals of 1,018 letters, for argument's sake. So now what we do is we write the text of the Torah, or Bereishis, whatever it is you're looking at, we write it in lines 1,018 letters long. Are you with me? Or minus one, so that you can read downwards, whatever it is, my arithmetic is not so hard. Now, that's what you do. And then, of course, what you'll have is the word Dreyfus will be spelled reading down, okay? At the beginning of the first line, if you started with that talent, you'll read the word Dreyfus down, okay? Or you can position it, of course, so it comes out in the middle of your grid, the word. Then they try and look for all the other words that are connected with that historical event, like the date in which it happened, the Hebrew date in which it happened, the names of the people who accused him, the name of the French officer who was discovered to be the one who was the spy in the end, and so forth. And they again spell them out at equidistant number sequences. Now you realize that if those words are spelled out anywhere in the vicinity of the same type of interval, you'll find it readable on the same grid. Is that correct? Because, you follow me, let's say you've got a grid now 1,000 letters long and it spells out the word you want. So then if you've got another word that they say 1,003 letters between all the words, so you'll find it going in jumps of three down the lines of your grid. Okay. So now, so we can look for those. And they assembled all the words that they thought might be associated with the word that they're looking for. And then they tried to see how closely are those words associated in the text that you have formed. You with me? You've got the word Dreyfus over here, okay? It appears, and sometimes, let's take an example that makes it more graphic to see. Let's take you take the word Dreyfus, and it's spelled out in intervals of 18. So then you'd have a massive grid of the Torah, some of them as long as this room, okay? Sometimes you might have 1,000 letters in a grid, only a few lines long, are you with me? Or you might have a long, narrow grid that way. But let's say you've got a grid. On that grid, you have the word, let's say Dreyfus, spelled out at jumps of 18, or on your grid, it'll be spelled out one line below the next. Now, where do all the other words that are associated with that event, where do they appear on the grid? So a statistician would expect them to appear all over the place. One of them might start over here and end up over there. Another one might be somewhere at the end of it, you follow. And they found that the words associated with that word intersect on the grid. Okay? They touch it, they begin with it, they end with it, they intersect, they are very, very closely connected. For example, in the example of this particular one, they found the name Dreyfus the prosecuting officer in the trial, the date on which it happened, the person who accused him, the spy, all those names intersect on the same spider. You might not be too excited about that, but what that means is that statistically, or from a probability theory point of view, is mind-boggling, staggering. Okay? Are you with me? Are you staggered? You have to understand a little bit of arithmetic to understand how this works, but that is what they found. In other words, the probability of just two of those things coinciding is hair-raising in its steps. You know, how many noughts you need after the one. And they found that they all, many, many things turned out to be, some of them stretch imagination. For example, they look for certain medical, I happen to look at this one being a doctor. So they look for certain medical terms. And they found the most amazing things. For example, they found the word sakeret. Sakeret is the Hebrew word for diabetes. As a modern Hebrew word, you don't find it in Tanakh. Sukkar in Hebrew is sugar. Sakeret is the word that's made up by modern Israelis, because it's a word that's based on the word sukkar. I mean, it's got nothing to do with Torah, that word. You wouldn't find that word in Torah anyway. But the word sakeret in Hebrew overlies the word for love, which is the pancreas. The word sugar, the word sakeret, the word a disease. Okay? Some of the forms of treatment for the disease. Insulin, for example. The word insulin, spelled out in Hebrew, overlies. And not only that, but it also overlies the English words for the same thing. That means you'll find that the word love, which means pancreas, overlies the English word pancreas, spelled out in Hebrew letters. You follow me? All on the same, which... Of course, we don't get excited about this kind of thing. What's a coincidence here and there? You know, a few million years of being a gorilla, you know, you're bound to get a few of these. Anyway, the point is that's what was done. Then there were some sophisticated studies done, which were some very, very beautiful examples. I'll give you one beautiful one. It says that when Yaakov met Esav, just to give an example of the kind of things people have looked at, when Jacob met Esau, right? Yaakov met Esav and Brashis. So there it says that Yaakov was punished for hiding his daughter Dinah. His daughter Dinah, by rights, should have married his brother Esau, according to certain calculations. But because he was a negative, evil man, Yaakov felt that it would be a terrible thing for her to marry him, even though there was a chance she might have fixed him up, right? As a good woman can. But nevertheless, Yaakov felt that it was too risky, and he hid Dinah. And it says in Midrash, he nailed her into a crate. He nailed her into a box, so that when Esav came to look upon his family, he wouldn't see this beautiful girl, Dinah, and want to marry her, and therefore she'd be safe. And it says Yaakov was punished for that. Why? Because he should have regretted the fact that his own brother couldn't marry his daughter, didn't regret it enough, etc. But that's the point. Now, when Rashi deals with that text of the Torah, the text says the following thing. The text says that Yaakov met Esav, and it talks about their meeting. Now Rashi says, and it talks about the number of children who were present. So Rashi says, V'dina heichan ha'Esav. Dina, where was she? How does Rashi know that Dina was missing? Because the number of children mentioned are one less than there should have been. So obviously somebody was missing from the accounting. So Rashi says someone's missing. Who was it? It was Dinah. Where was Dinah? And Rashi tells you that Yaakov hid her in a box so that Esav shouldn't see her. Now the question that bothered the commentaries since the days of Rashi is, how did he know that? What right does Rashi have to say that Dinah was... Alright, the Midrash says so. But where do you see in the text? That's the question. So there was one child missing. Maybe somebody wasn't there. You know, so one of the others wasn't there. One of the brothers. How do you know Dinah wasn't there? And we know it from the Midrash. That's not the problem. The problem is, where does it say it in the text? So they analyzed that section of Torah, and on the same grid, that means right in that parsha, that little section of Torah that talks about that event, if you count in intervals of 49, forwards and backwards over there, you find the name Esav, Yaakov, Shechem being the man who ultimately raped Dinah and wanted to marry her, right, and the Chazal say it was a punishment because they hid her from the man that she should have married. She was raped by a man that she shouldn't have. So his name is spelled out there, and in the middle of it all, hidden is the word Dinah. Okay? That means in the text, spelled out, overlapping all the names of what happened in that incident, is her name also spelled out at the same intervals as the others all are. That's a beautiful example. There are many others that have been done. I'll just mention one more detail just to fill you in on the rest of the picture, and that is that a very beautiful study mathematically was undertaken in order to prove this thing, let's say prove it mathematically from a statistical point of view, by looking for things in advance. And I'm not going to go into detail. What they did was, very, very briefly, this is the only study that I've seen that did it in this fashion, and so I'll mention it to you. They took the names of the 35 men or women who are mentioned, who have the 35 longest entries in Encyclopedia Judaica. If you go through the Encyclopedia Judaica and you look up the 35 longest entries, So you'll come up with Rashi, the Rambam, certain great figures of Jewish history throughout the ages. They took those 35, spelled out their names in all the variety of ways that their names can be spelled out, their birth dates, death dates, and various other facts about them, and set out to find, because that's a set of facts that are arbitrarily chosen, to see whether the Torah text compresses all those facts. Okay? And they found out that in all cases, the fantastically high proportion, statistically significantly, all the facts about that particular person, birth date, death date, where they lived, the famous work that they wrote, right, are all compressed, all spelled out right next to each other in the text of the Torah. They then, of course, controlled that by trying to do it in the Masoretic text. They tried to do it in certain secular literature. They tried to do it in many other ways to see, and of course, as expected, it gives you a totally flat line. In other words, there are no points of unexpected coincidence, statistically speaking, in other texts. They sent it to one of the greatest statisticians in the world, a non-Jew in England. He asked him to repeat the same test again with what's called, I forget the technical term, but what it means is scrambling the data by a factor of one. In other words, he asked them to rewrite the text of the Torah, knocking out the order by one. Instead of having the text the way we have it, just to juggle the order by throwing in a variable that will knock it all out of sync, starting off with only one. Okay, and the whole thing collapsed entirely, which is an incredible thing. It means that the text as we have it, exactly to the letter, exactly where they are, supports this whole structure. But if you change the text, in other words, let's get back to what we started with this evening, okay? If you try and say that, yes, the text is probably pretty close to what Moshe Rabbeinu received, but you know, over the thousands of years, you know how it goes with these things, somebody copied it over, you know, the printing error here and a writing error there, and like it's probably pretty close, but you know, this word might be spelled with an extra vav or vav letter. So the fact, incredible fact is, if you try and take the Torah and take out a vav any place, take out a letter any place in the Torah, add a letter anywhere, the whole thing collapses. This vast array of statistical and mathematical patterns, codes that stretch from the beginning of Bereshit to the end of Devarim, they all collapse. You follow? If you just affect one letter anywhere, many of them collapse. Are you with me? This is incredible insight into the integrity of the text as we have it. It's not a proof by any means. This is not a proof at all, and we don't believe it because of this. But nevertheless, it's a very, very striking phenomenon. Another thing that happened when these texts came out, I'll just mention for completeness, is very interesting, is that I hate to even discuss this because it's tamei, it's impure, it's an embarrassment to the Jewish people, but let's just try and nail the last nail in its box, if we can, is that for the last 100 years or so, there's been a theory, an approach to Bible called Bible criticism. You know what this is. Started by a certain man in Germany, I don't want to mention his name. He started an approach to Torah which is called Bible criticism. It's taught in universities. There are many erudite Jews, usually of the older school, who go along to lectures by people who don't observe Torah at all, in this town also, where they talk about the literate, you know, greatness of the Torah and so forth and so on. Now, this school approaches Torah as if it's a literary document, okay? They analyze it by the tools of literature. Instead of looking at it from Torah point of view, they look at it from a point of view. For example, they look at style. So they come up, they look at style. Look at the style of the text, okay? What had that? You must understand they're starting off from a position that this is not divinely inspired. I hope that's clear, okay? That means that certain humans wrote this. Each prophet was a great man of great sensitivity, great spiritual and human sensitivity, greater than other people. And in his muse, you know, in his muse, he wrote this sort of thing, inspired by his inspiration. He wrote this beautiful, beautiful poetry which surpasses all other literature and so forth and so on, but it has nothing to do with divine, okay? Now, if we can see from the style, like when he lived, for example, we can date, you know, when Isaiah lived, because we know what literate style was current at the time. You follow what's going on here? And they come up with conclusions, for example, there were two or three Isaiahs. Why? Because Yeshaya changes his style. We know that he changes his style. Talking about a different thing. When he gets upset about things, he uses a style that's mournful. Okay? But they say, no, you see two different styles. So, are you with me? Therefore, there were two Isaiahs, and so forth and so on. One of the classic claims that this school of thought, or non-thought, has raised, is that they claim for many years, they claim that the Torah itself consists only of four books, and that the fifth book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, was added much later. Okay? There are many reasons for this. First of all, the style is very different. Big differences in style, if you understand their point of view. And also, it duplicates many things that are mentioned in the first four. It does, in fact, duplicate many facts that are mentioned before. We have a fantastical, mystical understanding of why it's duplicated. It's the same reason that a body has both sides always duplicated. If he wants to be a teacher, he's immediately invalid, as we said before. That's what it means, the love from Rebbe and Tav, from Rebbe to Tav, just like the love of a parent. Now you'll see that the way it goes, the pathway that it goes, the way the Rebbe gives over to the Talmud, you'll see it goes according to personality. And therefore only certain Rebbeim can give to certain Talmud. And the Talmud often doesn't understand. When the Rebbe teaches, he says things that the Talmud has to raise himself up to understand. I once heard from Rav David Weiss, who was a Mashgiach in the Kollel where I was studying in Yerushalayim. He told me the following thing. He told us the following thing one day. He told us an embarrassing story about himself. He said that when he was young, he went to Rabbi, his Rosh Hashiva. Rabbi Weiss's Rosh Hashiva was the famous, is the famous Rabbi Zangazim. Your understanding is that I'm not mystical also, Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch has a fantastic explanation. There's a very, very rich Torah that's written about why the book of Devarim repeats certain facts that have been written before, even though we have a tradition that the Torah never repeats anything. Are you with me? But they say that the Sefer Devarim, because it repeats things and because its style is different, so it was added many centuries later. The first four books were written in the deep mists of time, someplace in the Sinai Desert, and another this and that. But the book of Devarim was added relatively recently, and they think they know who did it, and so forth. Okay. Of course, you realize what those people are, according to the Rambam here, right? They've just cut out their share in the next world, right? Especially people who are knowledgeable and have studied it in depth, as the Rambam explains here. One amazing and beautiful, unexpected thing that the codes did was, many codes run from the beginning of Bereshit to the end of Devarim. You hear that? There are many codes, there are many words, for example, that have five letters. The first is found in a certain position in the first book, the second in the second, the third in the third, fourth, and the fifth in the fifth, in exact corresponding points, and it spells out the whole word. Now, and there are thousands upon thousands of these codes that stretch from beginning to end of the Torah. Which means that if you're going to accept their point of view, you have to say that these people would never claim that these codes are accidental. I mean, it stands up to too good a rigorous scientific and mathematical examination. Therefore, they would have to come and say, yes, well, what actually happened, you know what, it becomes very unwieldy. They'd have to say something like this, yeah, well, the person who wrote the first four books, back in the mists of time, of course was very gifted. This man, whoever he was, called him Moses, called him somebody else, very, very gifted man. Not only did he write a thing that's incredibly powerful in its human content and in its poetic value, but he actually built in the most incredible mathematical code that must have taken him a good few months to write. I mean, he really must have, you know, especially without a word processor, can you think? He must have, but he got it right. But now you have to say that this individual wrote four books and he wrote the code in such a way that he put in the first four letters of a five-letter word, knowing that some centuries down the line, somebody else would come and write the fifth book and complete the code. It just completely, you follow? This completely doesn't make any sense. And therefore, the school of Bible criticism squealed its last miserable squeal when the codes were discovered and hasn't been heard from since, except from a few old-timers who still think that they can, you know, discuss the spiritual world in literary terms, which of course is nonsense. Happened to be wrong.
Doesn't that make sense?
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. Because there are two options. Either the book was written by a man who changed his style at a certain point for certain obvious reasons in the text, or it was written by one man and completed by somebody else later. We have a Torah Shabbat Pe tradition that one man wrote it and it fits together from beginning to end, and the codes crisscross it. Okay? Codes are in Tanakh also, not only in Chumash, although it's much more extensively studied in Chumash. You follow? So why propose that one man came in? The only reason they propose it is because the whole thing isn't divine in the first place. It's human. And if it's human, it's amenable to examination of style. And if one man uses long words, another man uses short words, and we see that the style changes, two different hands that wrote it. That's the concept. But it's nonsense. It's wrong. It's also stupid. Are there any other... We're going to leave it there for this evening, okay, on this particular point. Now, next Sunday night. Did he say there's no issue? Okay. Are there any questions immediately related to what we discussed right now? Because I don't think we'll come back to the code. So that's a very important way. Okay, very briefly, have you got another 2 minutes? Yes? Okay, very briefly like this. The question here is, how come we didn't predict certain things from these codes? Okay, so now, the problem you'll realize immediately is in order to predict a thing, let's not use the word predict, in order to see a thing, you have to know what you're looking for. You need to know the names, okay? If you had known that a man by that name in that date, so then you could start putting them together, then you would see other things condensing around it that would be meaningful. But of course you didn't know that name until that man came to power and did what he did. Are you with me? So you don't know that name, so what are you going to go look for? In addition to that, listen, even if you do know a name, like an event is transpiring now, like during the Gulf War they did this. during the war. They did this. Okay, Leisen can present this to you if you need to see him next. Get a hold of him and ask him to present it. And what happened was you have accreting around a nucleus all these things as they transpire. But the problem is when you want to predict the next thing, like for example a date that's significant, well, there's a zillion ways you can read the dates that all coalesce on that particular thing. You follow me? So how are you going to know which one of them is significant until after the fact? Without a much deeper tradition about how you read this before the fact, you can't predict with this method. Okay? And it's one of the reasons we're not allowed to predict the coming of the Mashiach, because it's specifically hidden within this structure. Ask a Rebbe. Ask a Rebbe. A Rebbe might be able. He might be able to do it without the text. If this man is of clairvoyant insight, ask a Rebbe. Because she has told me. Okay, now, I must just mention at this point, okay, one more detail, which is as follows. This is critically important, and you have to hear this well, okay? And that is that these codes, brilliant and inspiring and thought-provoking as they are very, very insignificant in the fabric of what makes up our Jewish feeling and belief. Let me just explain very briefly. I checked this myself. I went to ask one of the greatest people of this generation. I asked a number of times to clarify this point, and I'll put it across to you very briefly. It's like this. We do not base our belief on this kind of thing, okay? Even if you're a very sophisticated mathematician and you do a study like this and you come up with a striking, startling figure that convinces you beyond all shadow of doubt, okay, with facts that would convince any statistician or mathematician that this could not be human and it could not be coincidental, we virtually disregard that fact and its significance. And I'll tell you very briefly why. There are two reasons why, okay? Are you all with me? You have to hear this very, very well. There are two reasons. The first and most important reason is that we have no tradition about this thing. Our entire approach to Torah is what we've been taught by our rabbi. What our rabbis have taught us, that is Torah. And we'll try and explain next week when we discuss, or the week after, the oral law, that even if they say black is white and white is black, we understand what they say and not what we think. That might sound strange. We'll have to back it up and go into it and study it. But Torah is, as the oral law tells us, and as our great sages have explained to us. And they did not give us tradition about this mathematical system. With very few exceptions, there was a great man called Rav Weissmandel, who was in the Nazi thing, and he brought out a number of these things. He had a tradition. He analyzed and pointed out certain points where this thing applies. He was taught by his rabbi. But apart from that, basically, we do not have a solid, are you with me? We do not have handed down by our great teachers from the days of the Rishonim, a tradition, a Kabbalah, that you can do this with a text and reach significant conclusions. And therefore, we are very, very suspicious of it. It's a fantastic thing, it's very impressive, and it's not forbidden to use. I checked this carefully, I asked my Rebbe, and he said, if you're dealing with someone who's totally insensitive to Torah, and you know that a fact like this would jolt him into being sensitive, then you may discuss it as something that will whet his appetite and make him interested, let's say. But to base belief on it, and to prove Torah because of this, a person definitely shouldn't do. Why? Because we do not have a tradition that this is a valid tool. And therefore, because we don't have a tradition, hey, Aleph, we don't put our trust in things that we don't have a solid Torah tradition for. Base. We are worried that since we don't have a tradition, it may be a red herring, and it may be sent as an ordeal to this generation. We are afraid that if we start putting our faith in such a system, somebody else will come up with some other religious work of a system of religion, let's say, that we think is wrong, and start showing you codes there. Maybe Hashem will put codes in those things over there because they have certain mystical power and because he wants to test us. And it says that the final ordeal will be when we've shown that Torah is wrong and everybody else is right, and despite that we'll have to stay with Torah. We know there's going to be such an ordeal. So we don't want to put our faith in a system, an aspect, and that what will carry us through in that ordeal is the knowledge that Torah is right because we know it, and because millions of Jews have died for it, and because great rabbis have taught us. But not because we can point to a fact that connects like this and like that, because if they're based on that fact and it collapses, okay, somebody else comes with something that's better mathematically or structurally, so then where will your faith be? One. Two, we are worried that maybe you'll send us a test where within Torah we might find that things that contradict it. Maybe we'll look at the Torah text and somebody will start looking for codes that prove, who knows, some other religion. Or that Torah's wrong, maybe. Who knows what? Or that you should drop some mitzvah or other or something that might be very convincing in the text. Then what will you say? If you've based everything else on the structure of the text, are you with me? And then the same tool itself shows you something against Torah. So the man or the woman who has based himself on his Rebbe and his understanding of Torah and giving his life for it, he'll be unmoved. But the person who's based himself on a tool that was suspect in the beginning, so he's going to be moved by the tool, just as he was there. He'll be moved, who knows what, will become a such person. Are you with me? That's the first reason. Therefore, we regard it as something interesting, but we do not base faith on it. And secondly, a deeper reason is this, that we consider it a smallness of the mind to need to be convinced by objective proof like this. We have as our pride the fact that we're attached to Hashem because we're His people. We are prepared to bleed and be tortured and die for it, and we've done that. Millions of people up to this generation, and probably even us at our weak, low level of Jewish commitment, probably, if put to the test, we probably would give our lives for it. Even us. And certainly in the previous generation, even little children did that willingly. People who've come to such a level of attachment to the one that they love, so they're not the people who need to fall to the loneliness of something bamboozling them with a mathematical thing that they don't really even understand properly. Are you with me? That's a lowliness and it's a smallness, and to be convinced it takes away the whole level of emunah. If a man walks up to you and he says he doesn't believe this whole thing, and you show him a few impressive figures, and now he believes, that that's not a greatness at all. That's a person who needed to be convinced and it needs to be shown proof, and now you force him to believe. That's not what the Jewish people is. The Jewish people are attached to Hashem because they're attached to Him, like a husband or a wife, who love each other, and they love each other with a loyalty that's totally unbreakable, and they wouldn't do anything to break that loyalty. And no matter what evidence they were presented about what the other person is said to have done, they would not break their love for that person or ever, ever, ever let them down. That's what love means. And that's the way we attach to Hashem. And therefore, we're not swayed by this thing. Therefore, it's interesting, and we can look at it, and we can think, but we don't base our emunah on it. Teacher of Rabbi Akiva. He never said anything he didn't hear from his Rebbe. Ever. Then the Gemara says, brings an example where Rabbi Eliezer said things his teacher said to him, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a teacher. Oh, the Gemara talks about the difference between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the greatest of his group of people. The only difference is, it says, they both knew the language of the birds, the language of the trees, they knew every aspect of Torah, everything there is to know about the world. The only thing is, when a bird flew over his head, one of them was so great that the bird would fly over, the other one was so great that the bird flew over his head would be singed, charred, black, and fall to earth, when it flew anywhere in his vicinity. I'm not sure that's Abba Lechaim, I don't know, but that's what happened. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a teacher of Rabbi Eliezer, and it happened once that he said to him, say something. He said to him, teach Torah. And Rabbi Eliezer opened up Pasach Va'amar, he opened up and said words that no ear had ever heard. Dvarim Shelo Shaman Oizim Me'olam. Words that no ear had ever heard, he was able to say. That means he was able to open up a Kabbalistic depth and teach Torah that no one on earth had ever heard. Ever heard! Moshe Rabbeinu, Rabbi, no one had ever heard. And the commentaries say, what's going on? You said about this man that he never said anything he'd never heard from his Rebbe. That means it was certainly said before. Certainly it was said before. His Rebbe must have said it. That's how he heard it. And if he heard it, he said it. He never said anything he did. So what do you mean he said things that nobody had ever heard? You hear the contradiction. It couldn't be more blatant. So the Mefarshim answer as follows. Reb Nochum of Mir and Reb Chaim Shmulevitz of Mir, they both had two different opinions. And I heard this from a man who epitomizes this. If anybody on earth that I've ever met is this, this is the person. And he told me the following thing, that his two Rebbeim used to have a standing argument for many years, what's pshat? What exactly does it mean that he said things that no one had ever heard, and he said only that which he'd heard from his Rebbe? How do you resolve that? There are two opinions. And they're both very, very similar. And it's this. He never said anything he hadn't heard from his Rebbe. Absolutely not. Everything he heard was from his Rebbe. And true, he said things that no one else had ever heard. You know what it means? He was able to say things that no one had ever heard. But where did he get it from? He heard it in the words of his Rebbe. The one opinion was this. When his Rebbe taught, he was able to listen, and he was able to hear so deep that he could bring out from between the lines, he could say, and when he brought it out, you see that that's what his Rebbe had said. No one had ever heard this statement before. It was so great, it was so beautiful. But when you understood the statement, and you understood the Torah that he was saying, you understood where he got it from, and it was perfectly and exactly, all he did, in other words, was he showed what his Rebbe had said. You wouldn't have understood it. That was his greatness, and that's what he was here for. The other opinion is, no, he didn't read it between the lines of what his Rebbe said. You wouldn't find it. It wasn't evil. If you looked in the words of his Rebbe, you wouldn't see that. But what it means is, he knew his Rebbe so intimately and so well, that he was able to say what his Rebbe would have said about that thing. That means he never said it, but just by accident, he never happened to say it. But he said it so clear and so good, so pure and so close to the source of what his Rebbe was, that there's no question his Rebbe would have said that. And that we've seen many times. I'll tell you two examples. There was a case in a certain yeshiva. A group of Bochrim came to the Rebbe, and they said to the Rebbe, we found a Rashi that we can't understand. Listen, it's an amazing story. This happened in this generation. We found a Rashi that we can't understand. In an outlying Masechta that people don't often learn, Rashi says the following thing, and it doesn't make any sense. So the Rebbe said to the following thing, you're making a mistake. I've never seen that Rashi. Listen to this. This is a man who specialized in Rashi. Rashi's commentary, it absorbs it in all its depth, such as is possible in our generation. He said, you're making a mistake. I've never seen that Rashi, but he can't say that. It's just not Rashi. They went back and checked that, made a mistake. It so absorbed the mind, the way of thinking of that great giant Rashi. You know, it happened. Understand what this means to be able to absorb the mind of someone. It happened, an incredible thing happened in the first part of the century, around the turn of the century. There was a young yeshiva man who forged a copy of the Yerushalmi. Understand what this means. In the Gemara Yerushalmi, you know, we don't have all the Masechtas. We don't have all the tractates of the Gemara. We have in the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, we have a certain number of tractates. In Yerushalmi, we have fewer. It's not clear if they were never written, or perhaps they're missing. So a young yeshiva man faked a Masechta of the Yerushalmi. Anybody who knows what Gemara is, they're amazed by such a thing. I mean, just to be able to understand one line of the Gemara is a work that takes a lifetime. But to be able to dream up and write a whole tractate of the Gemara, right, possibly, that means that it would read like a Gemara, with a depth and logic and cohesiveness that a Gemara has. A stupendous human feat. An unbelievable feat. So he, there was this idea of a joke. You know, that's the kind of problem Jews we had in that generation. You know, somebody would fake a Yerushalmi, you understand, you know. That's the criminal element that the Jewish people had in 300 years ago. You know, that was the Jewish, you know, that was the worst you could find, you know. Somebody's idea of a joke was to, just for fun, write a copy of the Gemara. Understand what we've sunk to in this generation, this hopeless, almost hopeless generation. But anyway, that's what he did. And he showed it to the Gedolim of his day. He showed it to great men. And many great people gave us comment. Many great people testified that it's a great find. Until he came to the Rogachev. The Rogachev Gaon was a man who was so sharp. He was of such acerbic wit and of such sharpness. I mean, he once referred to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman as a leading light of his generation as a malamed, you know, like a cheder teacher. He was a great light of Torah in his day. The Rogachev was incredibly sharp. I mean, you'll permit me 2 minutes. I'll just take an aside just to show you who he was. Rogachev was a man. Understand what a teacher was, what a rebbe was. He was a man of such genius that when he was dying, he was in such pain that he couldn't stand the pain. He was in tremendous pain. And in those days, he didn't have anything effective to relieve his pain. So what did they do? The yeshiva bochrim went into him one after another to talk to him in learning. Because when he started talking in Torah, he didn't feel any pain at all. That was his level. He was in incredible agony. And all they had to do was engage him in a Torah conversation. And there was a man of his generation, by the way, went through a full operation without an anesthetic. Because anesthetic, the doctor said, was dangerous for him. He said, it's not a problem. He said, just pass me a masechta of such and such. He allowed the operating table. He went through the Gemara. And they finished the operation and feel a thing. One of the Hasidic rabbis of that generation. Not problem at all. It's not a concentration. The Rogachev was in agony. So the Bochrim went to speak to the Rogachev in learning. So when they engaged him in a discussion in Torah, in learning, he didn't feel any pain. The trouble is, the Rogachev was so sharp and so acerbic and so, he was so fiery that no one could stand his comments. So no Bochrim would dare to go speak to him in learning. Because the things that he would do would slice you up. But nobody could stand up to him. Not even the best of them could stand up to him. So what did they do? What are they going to do? They're going to speak in learning and be fried. So this is what they did. The Bochrim and the Yeshiva, they studied up Rabbi Kiva Eger's comments on the Gemara had just come out. Rabbi Kiva Eger was an incredible luminary of his day. Also, and a whole discussion to describe him also. Rabbi Kiva Eger was an incredible genius in Torah, whose commentaries on many pages of the Gemara. While he learned the Gemara, what's called the Kiyas, that means as he flew through the Gemara, he used to note down a few little points here and there through the Gemara, which are some of the deepest questions that we have today. Almost unstoppable questions. When he leaves the Torah Chiyun, this needs further thought. When Rabbi Kiva Eger leaves the Torah Chiyun, it's almost impossible. You have to be a very foolhardy individual, had a very, very enormous self-confidence to tackle such a question. They're one of the heaviest and deepest questions ever been asked in our day. So they, all the Bochrim swatted up a question of Rabbi Kiva Eger that the Rogachev hadn't seen. It had just come out. You follow? So they didn't tell him where they got it. Each Bocher went in and he asked the question of this giant. Follow? Each young yeshiva Bocher, are you with me? He went into this man in agony and he said, Rebbe, I'd like to ask you a question. And he asked him a question that Rebbe Kiva Eger asked on the Gemara without telling him where it came from. So the story goes that one after another the Bochrim went in and he answered them all on the spot. And at the end he said, good Bochrim. That was Rebbe Kiva Eger. That was the Rogachev. So the Rogachev, just to show you how his mind One day he was learning with the Or Sameach, just trying to give ourselves a little filia for who these great people were. One day he sat in the Beis Medrash. His Chavrusa was the Or Sameach, after whom this yeshiva is named. The great Or Sameach, named after him because he had no children. He lived in Minsk. In Dvinsk, he was the leading Torah authority in Dvinsk, first part of the century. One day they were sitting and learning together, and they both had incredible sense of humor. Tremendous, biting wit. They were sitting and learning together. So they came to a Tosis they couldn't agree on. They had a massive argument about the Tosis. The one said chat one way, the other one said that, and couldn't settle it. So as they were busy arguing, a man walked into the Beis Medrash. He was never a man who was known that he always said wrong. Whatever you asked him, he always said wrong. It was a roar from another town. This man was always, it was well known, unfortunately, that he had a krum kop, and he'd always say whatever. So they both made a plan. They said, listen, we'll go and ask him. And whatever he says, the other one will be right. So the Rogachev agreed. So they went over and they asked the man, and he said, like the Or Sameach. So they sat down at the table. So Rogachev looked across and he said, no. So the Or Sameach said, look, it's just before Pesach, and he's confused. He just said right because he's confused, but had he been thinking straight, he would have said wrong. That's a Gemara joke. Anyway, these were the. So when this young man took his copy of the Gemara Yerushalmi that he had forged, faked, fraudulently produced, he showed it to the Rogachev. Rogachev took one look at the Gemara and he said, Rabbi Meir says this and this. This is a forgery. So the young man admitted it. He said, how did you know? So Rogachev said, because you say over here that Rabbi Meir says such and such. He could never say that. That's just not consistent with who he was. That means he was able to look into the mind. Right? He knew the mind of the Tanna at his level so deeply that he could look at one comment of the Tanna and say, this is a fact. That man could never have said that. That means he absorbed his mind so intimately, so intensely, was able to say that. And you find that, finally, we'll just try and make this point, that the way the mind of the Rebbe works and the way the mind of the Talmud works is that it's a perfect marriage so that the Talmud can reflect the mind of the Rebbe. And in general, I just want to make one, talk about one detail of this relationship that often misunderstood. And that's as follows. There are two kinds of rebbeim in Klal Yisrael. The person has to remember this and understand it. Some of the things we said this evening are confusing. We're trying to just begin to open up the subject. There are two kinds of rebbeim. Let's just leave ourselves with this idea. You have the kind of rebbe who is completely humble and can be walked on and trampled on. And he's completely soft and doesn't hit back or bite. And you have the kind of Rebbe who's fire. The Gemara says, beware of the Talmidei Chachamim because their sting is a scorpion sting. And they bite, they fire, they bite. Serpents bite and a scorpion sting. They're very, very sharp. The Talmid has to know, he has to be able to take it from his Rebbe. His Rebbe has to tell him what's wrong with him or he has to correct him. He has to be able to take it. But there are two different kinds of Rebbe. There is a Gemara says that if a person has to choose which way to be, should be like Hillel and not like Shammai. Hillel was a man who was easily the Gemara tells the famous story, the source of this, the two lines in Klal always has been the gentle line, the chesed line, the right hand side, and then there's always been the tough, the line of fire and of discipline. That's always been called the left hand side, the line of Shammai. The Gemara says that a certain non-Jew, a certain Jew, a certain person came, a non-Jew also came, a certain Jew came to see Shammai. And he bothered him, asked him silly questions. He had a bet with his friend, a bet. The Gemara brings the whole story. It's a whole Amud of Gemara. Interesting. Going into the details now. But this man came to Shammai. Shammai was from the line of Rebbeim that are fire. And he said to him, he asked him stupid questions. And Shammai drove him out with what's called a builder's yard. He used to carry around a builder's yard stick. And with Washi Maral says it doesn't mean he carried his stick around. It means he did everything by measure. He was perfect in. And he held that for the honor of Torah, he had to be fiery like that. And he chased him out. So the man went to Hillel. The bet was whether he could upset and disturb Hillel. So he took his friend a bet, 400 zuz, I think it was a fortune. He went to Hillel, and he chose to get him on Friday afternoon, as he was in the bath just before Shabbos. The tensest time of the week. In any frum home, if fights do break out between husband and wife, that's the time, because the house is tense, and there's only minutes to go before Shabbos, and things aren't finished. So he stood outside and he said, Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel. Called him by his first name. No Rebbe, no title of respect. Who's Hillel, who's Hillel? So Hillel came out in his bath, got out the bath, and he said, yes, my son. That was his way. So he said to him, why do the Patagonians have wide feet? So Hillel said, because they walk on soft sand, my son. So they don't sink in. Went back to his bath. So he came back a few minutes later and said, Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel. And a full voice, everybody could hear. So Hillel came out and said, yes, my son. He said, why do the Chinese have narrow eyes? He said, they have a lot of sandstorms, my son. Narrow eyes, the sand doesn't get in. And again and again, and he asked him, and he gave him a deep questions and answers also. I'm not going to go into it. Finally, he said, he couldn't upset him. So he said, may there be few like you in Israel. May there not be more like you. Even that Hillel had to hear. So he said, my son, why do you say that? So he said, because of you, I've lost a fortune. So Hillel said to him, better that you should lose a fortune than Hillel should get upset. That's what he said. That's a famous piece of Gemara. You see, there were Rabbeim who could be treated that way without losing any of the honor of the Torah. Depends when to be sharp, when not to be sharp. Kevag himself was a man who was very soft. Himself, the one we mentioned before, he could be walked all over. But when he felt it was the honor of the Torah, he used to say things that people sometimes lost their lives because of. When the need was to be sharp, it's well known that a certain man wouldn't give his wife a divorce. There was a certain man who would not give his wife a get that he was obliged to give her. And they brought the man to see Rabbi Kiva, and he couldn't be forced. So Rabbi Kiva, he said quietly to the man, it's the Isha Yitzes, a get. Of a Misa Sabah. That's all he said to him. He said to him, a woman goes out with a divorce or the death of the husband. That's what he said. A divorce or the death. So the man said, no, he's not giving a divorce. So Rabbi Kiva quietly said to him again, Shayyeh, a woman goes out by a divorce or by the death of the husband. He stormed out the house and dropped dead on the front steps. There are many cases of things like that Rabbi Kiva was able to do that happened in the world. But unless that was the case with the honor of Torah, with some specific need, he could walk all over him. There have always been those two lines, and a person has to be very careful when he chooses a Rebbe if he can take it. Rebbe Yisrael Zalman Meltzer in Yerushalayim in the last generation was a man of incredible stature, a man, a very unusual man, and if somebody said something wrong in his presence, he was a towering giant, physically and spiritually. If someone said something wrong in his presence, he would smile gently and say, yes, yes, you probably mean, and then he would say the correct way, not to offend the person. And at the same time, there was the brisker Rav in Yerushalayim. If somebody said something in front of him that wasn't perfect Torah, he started to shake uncontrollably. Right? He couldn't take it. He had to take the person out. Right? There have been always those two lines. If a person has to choose, he should choose to be like Hillel. But if his personality is that, so he has to be. I happen to have been Zofia to learn from someone, and I say too much, who is somebody who happens to be particularly fiery. Particularly fiery. I once heard him express this idea. He once said that the Chiddush HaArim says, beautiful thing, you know, there's a halacha that a man must walk on the left of his Rebbe. When a man's walking together with his Rebbe, or somebody that he respects, he must walk on his left. Because the place of honor is at the right hand side. So when you walk with someone you respect, you must walk with him at your right. That's the place of honor. So the Gemara says that a man who walks on the right of his Rebbe is a boor, a fool. He's an idiot, he's a fool. He doesn't know anything, he doesn't learn anything. So the Chiddush HaRim asks, why is he a fool? He walks on the wrong side. So he walks on the right. So he doesn't know the halacha. Why does it call him a fool? Doesn't know anything. Never amount to anything because he walks on the wrong side of his Rebbe. So a beautiful insight of Chiddush HaRim, one of the great Rebbe's of Gur. Grandfather Spasemis, he said the following thing. The right and left don't mean the right and left. By the way, it does also mean the right and left. Halacha is you must walk on the left-hand side of your Rebbe. But it means much more than that. The right-hand side is always the side of the Rebbe that's kind and full of chesed. And the left-hand side of the Rebbe is always the side that's rock hard and full of discipline. A man who walks on the right-hand side of the Rebbe, that's a man who only wants to hear praise. He wants the gentle hand. He wants the hand of kindness and praise from his Rebbe. So he stands on the right. He can't stand to walk on the left. The left is a side of discipline where he gets smashed by the Rebbe. And he can't take that. So such a man's a fool. Because unless he puts himself in to being able to be put down where it's necessary and be corrected correctly by his Rebbe, he won't amount to anything. That's what he has to be able to do. And I heard him say, I personally heard him say, and he's one of the greatest men of this generation, indescribable giant. I heard him say, that before he heard a word of praise, this is, of all the things I've heard him say, this is the one that I have difficulty believing. Right? When I have to make an effort to believe him, this is the statement. This is the only statement. And I heard him say with my own ears that before he heard a word of praise from his teachers, and I know who his teachers were, I know who his rebbes were, his rebbe. Before I heard a word of praise, and he would never exaggerate, he would never say a word that isn't perfectly true, and I heard him say this, that before I heard a word of praise from my rebbeim, I heard them call me a fool 100 times. I can't imagine anybody calling him a fool. Not in his youngest years. And that's what I heard him say. How does he teach? If he had said to me some of the things that I've heard him say to some other people, I don't think I could have survived him. Once in a shoe, just to give you a faint taste. Once in a shoe, someone asked a question, a foolish question. He looked across the hall and he said to him, "That question's not even stupid." So 5 minutes later, the same person had the gall to ask another question. He said, "That's already stupid." It was an Israeli audience that could take it. And he once said that he's descended from the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi was a man who taught Torah in this fashion. He was a regal, royal personality who did exactly what he did and what was right in an absolutely royal way. Conducted himself in the conduct of Malchus, and you have to be perfect to do that. If you're easily walked upon and you're humble and you bend easily, so then you can afford to make mistakes. But if you're going to hold yourself to be in the fiery mode, you can't afford mistakes. Look like a fool. The Chacham Tzvi was able to do that. And he said, "I can say this because I'm descended from him." And he told the story. And the story is a well-known story that the Chacham Tzvi was so fiery that in his day in Europe, the town where he was Rav, they were unable to get on with him. He was so royal, so regal and so demanding that the people, and he had to leave. So what did he do? He went to the house of a certain poor, poverty-stricken Jew, poor Jew. He walked in and he said, "I've come to stay." Walked into the house and asked permission that I've come to stay. So the Jew was overawed by this great Torah presence and he started serving him. He started serving him and looking after him. And the Chacham Tzvi conducted himself in a way that made it very difficult. Very difficult. And after a lengthy period of staying with this man, one day this humble, poor individual came to him and he said, "Rebbe, I just have to tell you, I can't take it anymore. I just can't live like this." So the Chacham Tzvi said to him the following thing. "I want you to know that in exactly a week from now, I will receive a delegation from Vienna. They will come and ask me to be their rabbi, their rebbe, and I'll accept the invitation. And therefore I'm staying another week." And so he said, "I'm staying another week in your house. And because you've hosted me, because I've been in your house, I'm going to give you a brocha, I'm going to give you a blessing. And had you not spoken up now, had you been silent for one more week, I would have given you a blessing at Soif Kol HaDoros. That means a blessing that would have gone in your family until the end of all generations for incredible wealth. But because you spoke up, I'm going to give you a brocha anyway, but not necessarily Soif Kol HaDoros." And he gave him a brocha for wealth, and that was the father of the first Rothschild. That's the family connection. There's a true story. You see that there are two pathways. Even a Rebbe who can be gentle, but a person must be able to take it when the Rebbe's not. If it doesn't involve discipline, if a person isn't able to hear things that are scorching, and know how to take it, and know how to correct himself and mavatal himself so that he can absorb what the Rebbe's teaching, so then he won't amount to anything. We'll leave it there for this.